Welcome back, America. In a day full of news out of California, which is horrible, I'm closing my broadcast with Molly Ball. She's sticking around after the show to be the second guest in my On Background podcast series, talking with journalists about how they got into the business. The first one was so well received with Nigel last week that we want to continue it up. Molly Ball, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Great to have you.
Thank you, Hugh. Great to be here, as usual.
Let's start with the president and the First Amendment. Yesterday, a lot of us in the business were stunned to hear him talking about looking into licensing. That is clearly unconstitutional to license on the basis of content. How does the president not know that, Molly?
I mean, there appear to be a lot of things that this president doesn't know. And as we know, he operates on gut instinct. He lashes out on when he takes things personally, and he takes most things personally. So when he views media coverage that he doesn't like, his instinct is, how can I destroy my enemy? How can I destroy my opponent? And he's, you know, talked about the press as an enemy for quite some time now. It shouldn't be, I guess, too surprising that he would want to go on the attack.
Now, the idea of licensing, for those who don't know, and the Steelers fans, I enjoy a license on every radio station because the FCC has granted it to the station owner, because there's a limited spectrum that has to be divided up. Otherwise, you'll have crossover and scrambled signals. Same with television. Not true about cable. Therefore, the FCC gets to control content a little bit with regards to the words we cannot say and the phrases we cannot use. But they don't get to control political content. Political speech is the most protected core value in America. And I don't actually... Do you think Donald Trump actually wants speech police, Molly Ball?
I have no idea, right? And for those of us who've been covering this administration, that's always the impossible thing to know, is where is the line between stuff that Trump just says, because he says a lot of stuff and then doesn't follow through or doesn't mean it or is just blustering or is trying to sort of intimidate in some way but doesn't actually plan to put policy into place. And, you know, he's not very concerned with the minutiae of policy, so we certainly have not seen reported that he's in meetings, you know, every day with the FCC commissioner strategizing how to actually, in a concrete way, implement some of these threats he's making.
But he's
talking about it in pretty concrete terms, right? This is a step beyond just enemies of the people, which is alarming, but just rhetoric, right? This is actually proposing in some way to take concrete steps. So I do think that it goes beyond some of the bluster we've seen from him in the past about the media.
But I'm not actually alarmed. That's where, and when Bob Corker says World War III looms, no, it doesn't. And if it did, he wouldn't be holding up nominees for the ambassador to Germany, et cetera. People don't act like they say they feel. I have two things I got to get to you. 8 minutes ago, the president tweeted out the fake news caps, the fake capital F news, capital N, is going all out in order to demean and denigrate, exclamation point, such hatred, exclamation point. What do you make of that, Molly Ball?
It sounds like something I've heard him say a million times in the past, right? This is not a president who views media coverage dispassionately as something that, you know, is a matter of the facts, whether he likes them or not. He views it purely through the lens of, is this good for me or bad for me? And if it's bad for him, whether or not it's factual, it's automatically fake news.
So explain something for me, or guess. He did Hannity last night. He is very good at the long form one-on-one. And I don't care if it's Anderson Cooper or Sean Hannity, if it's Jake Tapper or Chuck Todd, he tends to dominate those settings. And I went round and round with him 15 times during the election. He wins at that. Why doesn't he do more of that and less of Twitter, where he doesn't get that opportunity?
Right, and that's exactly what I was going to say, is if he's so good at that, why isn't he talking to Anderson Cooper? Why isn't he talking to Jake Tapper? Why isn't he facing the people he believes to be his opponents mano a mano? If he thinks that he can take these guys on and win the argument with them and come out of that looking good, why isn't he doing it? We've seen this president really disengage from all but the most sort of sycophantic media and only talk to people like Sean Hannity, who's basically a propagandist for the regime, and
someone like yourself
who is ideologically sympathetic, but would, you know, ask him tough questions. And so
yeah, I do dissent. I think Sean asked some Sean asked some good questions last night. Sean did ask some good questions last night. He supports the president. But propagandist is tough, Molly. That's tough.
Being a little bit, I'm exaggerating a little bit.
All right. So let's go to then the one beef the president has, which is certainly legit. We had a minute left. Jim Mattis came out and said he did not call for a tenfold increase. Did everybody who reported it report the counter as often, as frequently as they ought to, in your opinion?
I have not done a systematic study of the coverage of that particular incident. We have seen the president send out members of the candidate to dispute accounts that he has a problem with. And, you know, sometimes the reporting is solid, and we in the media are going to stand behind our reporting if we believe it to be true, whether or not it is denied after the fact. So, you know, that was not my reporting. I can't say whether it's something that stands up or not.
All right, we will find out more on that tomorrow. Molly Ball sticking around for the podcast on background. Don't miss that. America will post it at HughHewitt.com and other places. Stay tuned. I am joined now by Molly Ball of The Atlantic on my podcast on background. The Hugh Hewitt Show has been bringing on Molly for years because she's a terrific radio guest. She actually answers the questions in under 2 minutes. but the on background premise, Molly Ball, is that people are very interested, especially young journalists, in journalists who've made a career out of it, and they want to know how it happened. So let's begin with, where is Molly Ball from?
Well, can I start with where I'm going? Because I'm not with The Atlantic much longer. In a couple of weeks, I am taking a job as national political correspondent for Time Magazine. So while I have had a wonderful 6 years at The Atlantic, I am moving on, and I think I owe it to my new employer to plug them a little bit on that score.
Congratulations. Time is a great,
very much. I'm
great
really
forum.
Excited about it.
But what's interesting, that underscores the fact that almost everybody who shows up on my show a lot has moved a lot over the, I've been doing this since July of 2000, so we're in year 18. And people move a lot in journalism, where the Dan Balzes of the world and the David Broders before him never move. That's one of the key defining things of the new era in journalism, isn't it, Molly?
Yes, absolutely. I would say the defining quality of this era of journalism is churn and uncertainty and fluidity. And that means that you can never feel secure in any particular job. I mean, I started out in the newspaper industry, and that's been in a really tough spot for a long time. And so people have had to be more nimble in their careers, because you never know. You can't necessarily, unless you're Dan Balz, who the Post, I think, ought to do absolutely anything in its power to hold on to for as long as he lives and breathes, you can't necessarily count on your job being there tomorrow. And so my advice to young journalists is always to try to be nimble, be flexible, and be entrepreneurial.
I think I've seen Marty Baron, the editor of the Post, grabbing lost hairs from Dan Balz and scraping DNA off coffee cups against the day when the science arrives that they can do Jurassic Park with Dan. Okay, Molly, back to my premise. My premise is lots of young would-be journalists at Medill at Northwestern or Cronkite at Arizona or the great schools at Syracuse or at Missouri, they want to know how you got to be Molly Ball. So take us back. First, where are you from?
Well, I was born in Boise, Idaho. Moved around a little bit as a kid, but mostly grew up in the suburbs of Denver, Colorado. Went to high school there. And, you know, when I was 12 years old in the Denver suburbs, I started my first newspaper.
Three
of my friends started a newspaper together and convinced the local office depot to give us free copies and went door to door selling subscriptions for like a quarter. And then, this will be familiar to anyone who's ever done a group project, my three friends flaked and I had to do it myself. But in retrospect, it seems like I was always a little bit wired for this. I worked
that
on my high school newspaper, and I worked on my college newspaper, and it was just something I always really enjoyed.
That goes to my theory that in the Genome Project, they will find something marked newspaper gene. It's become different now, but they will find that. So what did the 12-year-old paper report on?
Oh, gosh, I don't even remember. There were probably a lot of silly jokes and recipes. I don't remember it being particularly hard news.
Which college did you go to? Which paper did you work on?
I attended Yale University, and I worked on the Yale Herald, the weekly newspaper there, not the Yale Daily News, because I had other interests in college. I didn't necessarily know that I wanted to go into journalism. I wanted to try a bunch of different things. I worked on the literary magazine. I was in an orchestra. But I did work for the weekly newspaper, which is sort of the scrappy underdog, right? It was always really fun to scoop the bigger paper and get one over on them. And
Decades before you did that, I did that at Harvard, because the Crimson required too much of your life, but the Harvard Advocate required that you show up every couple of weeks and write something. So that was the better of the two options. However, the Daily News has a pipeline into journalism. What was the first job out of Yale for you?
Well, I started doing newspaper internships while I was still in school. So my first job after my sophomore year was with the Toledo Blade, where the night editor made me cry, and I didn't know anyone in Toledo, but I still loved it. I loved it, and that was really when I realized maybe this is something I want to do with my life. And so the following summer, I interned for the paper in Pittsburgh, the Post-Gazette. During my senior year, I took almost no classes and spent 3 days a week driving up to Hartford to intern in the New York Times Connecticut State Capitol Bureau. And after I graduated, I interned for the Washington Post, figuring that that was it. I was set for my career. The internship has traditionally been the Post pipeline into journalism. My year, this is 2001, so right at the time that newspapers are really falling apart, but digital journalism isn't yet really a thing, right? There's no Huffington Post, there's no Politico, there's no TheAtlantic.com. And my year, the Washington Post had a hiring pause and did not hire any of their interns. So all of a sudden, I had to scramble to figure out what to do next.
And you're thrown into the torrent. I wrote a book called Blog in 2005 that talked about the disintermediation of audience from everything except byline. The byline became the brand just in those years. How did you survive? How did you make any money 2001 to 2005?
Well, I moved to Asia. I had been working in a suburban bureau of the Washington Post, writing things like features about fruit stands, which, while lyrical and glorious, was not the reason I got into journalism. So when I ended up without a job, I decided I wanted to take that year abroad that I never did in college. So on September 10th, 2001, I interviewed with the publisher of the Cambodia Daily, an English-language newspaper in Phnom Penh, and he offered me an unpaid internship. The next day was 9/11. I decided to leave the country for a while, and 3 weeks later, I was on a plane to the first developing country I had ever set foot in. So I spent two years living and reporting in Cambodia, which was an experience that really shaped the way I see the world and the way I understand journalism. It was a fantastic and a formative and important experience.
Yeah, I think of Brett Stevens doing the Jerusalem Post. I think of others who've gone abroad for their first gig, and I'm reminded, I tell audience often of young people, the 8 most important words in the English language are, I know a guy, and have you ever considered? So who asked you, have you ever considered working for the Cambodia newspaper? Who suggested that?
Nobody did. I wanted to go overseas, and so I asked around, and a friend of a friend of a friend had worked at the Cambodia Daily. The paper has a Cambodian staff and a staff of expats who put the paper together jointly, and so I heard about this in the course of my own reporting process and got in touch with them.
I know a guy or I know a gal is really the key to everything. So after you came back, what did you come back to?
Well, I went through cancer treatment, and then I was unemployed, and then I got a job at the Las Vegas Sun, which at the time was a sort of failing afternoon daily in Las Vegas, but Vegas is a great news town, so I was really lucky to wind up there. And after a couple of years as a general assignment reporter at the Sun, writing investigations and features and covering criminal justice a little bit, the bigger paper in town, the Review Journal, wanted to hire me so I would stop scooping them. But the only job they had open was covering politics, which I'd never done before. But I convinced them I could do it. And in 2006, I started covering Nevada politics for the Review Journal, and I did that for 3.5 years, covering state legislature in Carson City, covering, you know, gubernatorial campaigns and local campaigns, but then also covering the 2008 presidential election in a state that had an early caucus and was a swing state. So I really got to understand American politics from the ground up, from the local level, which I think is immensely valuable to the way I understand politics, that I didn't get my start in D.C. I started in a place where the rubber hits the road in terms of politicians and campaigns engaging with voters.
You also started in a place with the remarkable Ralston, which we'll come back to, but you dropped in there. you had cancer treatment. What sort of cancer did you have? How difficult was the treatment, and how did it affect your ambitions?
I was extremely lucky. I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is almost completely curable. I was diagnosed on my 24th birthday, and I went through 12 weeks of chemo. And so even though the cancer was in stage 4, this is, again, a type of cancer that's been almost completely curable for many, many years. And so after 12 weeks of chemo, I was cured, and I have never, I'm not even really considered in remission anymore once you don't have symptoms for 5 years after treatment, you have no better chance of having a recurrence than anyone in the general population has of getting the disease. So I'm very lucky. I went through chemo and went on to have 3 children and been pretty healthy since then.
Molly Ball, you've got a remarkable set of experiences that set you up to have perspective inside the Beltway. I sometimes think one of the great cliffs that we're dancing on is that many of the reporters in the Manhattan Beltway media elite are young and lack life experience, so that politics looms too large. Are you defensed against that better than other young reporters?
I certainly hope so. I've seen a lot of America. I've lived in a lot of different places. I live inside the Beltway now, but I spend most of my time, and consider it my job, to get out there in America and see what's happening on the ground. So I do think that the experiences that I've had have been valuable in informing, in giving me a broader perspective, and I've actively sought out experiences to give myself a broader perspective, and I hope that informs my journalism.
2 last questions. Advice for young journalists and your ambitions going forward. Take them in any order that you want.
Well, you know, I, as of just 7 years ago, considered myself a failed journalist. I couldn't get out of Las Vegas. There was no upward mobility in the newspaper industry. And long story short, my husband, who's also a journalist, he and I moved to Washington, D.C. with 2 unemployed journalists, an infant, and a small amount of savings, and couldn't get our calls returned at any of the major outlets here because nobody knew who we were. And Politico finally gave me a chance, and after a year there showing what I could do and getting a foot in the door, I got my dream job at The Atlantic. So the lesson from that is, first of all, that the old path that I tried to take through newspapers, where you start in a smaller market and move up, that's broken now, and I wouldn't advise anyone to rely on it. But what there is now is there are a lot of jobs in digital journalism, and The Atlantic still has our wonderful 160-year-old print magazine, but most of our content now is on theatlantic.com. And there's a lot of different digital news startups, some of them partisan on both sides of the aisle, some of them not. But that means that there are jobs in journalism now. And if you are entrepreneurial, if you build your brand on social media and make connections and put yourself in the conversation, you really can make a career this way in a way that gives me some hope for a business that's obviously been on tough times for a while.
So, and Molly Ball, what is your ambition?
My ambition is to continue to cover the news as fairly and as accurately and as entertainingly as possible. I mean, one of my experiences that I didn't come up as a political reporter specifically. It was something I happened into. My priority as a journalist has always been to tell good stories, stories that matter to people and stories that people want to read. So I think a political story should be a good story, whether or not someone cares about politics. And so my ambition is to tell good stories that happen to be about politics and that tell people things they didn't know and that help them understand the world.
And now to do it at Time.com. Last question. Do you want your babies to grow up to be cowboys or journalists?
Well, so far, my little boy seems to want to be a bus driver, so I just want them to follow their hearts and do what makes them happy and work hard.
Well said, Molly Ball. Thank you for joining us. Congrats on the move to Time Magazine. Continue to come back to the Hugh Hewitt Show, and thanks for being on Background.
Absolutely. Thank you, Hugh.